Good afternoon and welcome to the Wednesday call for the long-term care providers. It's Mike Cook, Director of Long-Term Care. I want to remind you that all calls are muted and the session is being recorded. We will have a question and answer session at the end and you'll be able to submit questions and we'll be able to answer them. As always, you can contact us at 405-271-6868. Probably will not get an immediate response, but we try to get back to everybody within 24 hours. There's a lot of people with questions out there right now. Or an even simpler method is just to email us at ltc@health.ok.gov. You can also find our COVID resources on the website at ltc.health.ok.gov. And I believe the agenda has been sent out, and I was just going to give you a reminder that if you saw a old one, just be sure to hit Control F5 to get the refresh. And we'll start with our policy and guidance, turn it over to James Jocelyn, our Assistant Deputy Commissioner.
Good afternoon, everyone. We'll start today with a review of the plan that was issued and kind of take you through the plan. The plan document, which is linked in your agenda, has four parts to it. An introduction that kind of gives an overview, but importantly specifies that there is a phases template in this plan for nursing facilities. Then beyond that, there is the ability to adapt that template to other provider types. And so because of the unique nature of the various providers that we have, the resolution for that was don't try to write a one-size-fits-all plan. Let facilities review with an infection preventionist the CDC guidance and develop their plan. One approach would be to take the template, the phases template, and look at that plan and look at the CDC guidance and revise that template based on your facility and your practices that you've identified for your facility. We recognize that and we've received a lot of calls about, well, what about this? Well, what are we supposed to do here? There is there's discretion there. We're asking, providing you the authority to go to the CDC guidance, to review that for whether it's group homes or for residential care. And as you dissect that with your infection preventionist, you will arrive at, here's what we want to try. Now, here's the approach that we're going to take for phase one, phase two, phase three. So there's not a subsequent, oh, we're going to issue a plan for assisted living. It is the document that you have, taking the template as a tool, which breaks down, you know, for the different phases, different areas to talk. To cover about how you're going to approach things and that you develop those areas for your facility based on the CDC guidance. The next part of the plan, I would say that as a part of that intro, there is also specified the statement at the bottom of the first page that facilities may use discretion to be more restrictive in certain areas where deemed appropriate through internal policies, through your plan. So you can look at the CDC guidance and say, well, that doesn't really cover this or it doesn't kind of get into this piece, so I'm going to use the nursing home piece or I'm going to use something in between. So that's, and even beyond that, with that statement, facilities can look at the phase document and say, okay, but I'm going to be more restrictive here. I'm going to put this in place. So that authority is provided in the plan. The next part of the plan applies to all provider types, and it's the requirement for an infection preventionist. We have provided in this agenda, let's see, I'm going back through here, that we provided links to the training and the template that's referenced in the plan, that all facilities need to have an infection preventionist to do or to update a risk assessment for their facilities. And so for a number of facilities, they already have, certainly our nursing homes and ICFI IDs all are required to have an infection prevention and control plan. That's based on a risk assessment. And so their expectation is to update that for COVID using the risk assessment tool that's provided through the CDC's Infection Preventionist Training Program. The intent here, as we talked about when I talked about the infection preventionist a couple weeks ago, is to get a set of eyes whose job is to look at your infection prevention and control practices, look at what surveillance systems you have in place to monitor for signs and symptoms of COVID in your facility or in fact, generally, other infectious diseases, to monitor how the PPE is being worn, monitor how the screenings are being done, and look at what systems are in place. That person is your person who is going to the CDC guidance and studying that guidance, talking to our acute disease folks to work and develop to revise those practices based on new emerging guidance from CMS, from CDC. So we are that requirement is in there, and the plan specifies that all the facilities will identify for us who that person is with an email and phone number, and that's in there because we want that infection preventionist to be a conduit for us to push latest updates, guidance on PPE and other information so that we've got a point source contact for the facilities to interface with in providing infection control information. The infection preventionist requirement is that they be a licensed healthcare professional. Not been more specific than that. So we've had some questions pop up. It's a licensed healthcare professional is the standard. If you have someone that you believe meets that definition, then submit them. The standard then is that they're identified to us, they submit their infection prevention and control plan, their risk assessment, and the monitoring plan to us. Those all go to ltc@health.ok.gov, where that will be reviewed. You'll be provided feedback and an affirmative response of something you might need to tweak or otherwise that this looks good. The link to that template, and there's been some confusion on this, there is a specific infection prevention and control risk assessment template that is provided by the CDC that is not the CDC's assessment tool for COVID. So this is a separate assessment tool. You might use them combined. I've linked you, there's a link in the agenda to that risk assessment tool. It's an Excel file that you can from the agenda link to it. This is also linked in the plan. Keep in mind that as we stated in the document, the assessment tool is to be adapted to your facility type. Just as we note that as you go through the infection prevention and control training, you will see pieces, because this was designed for nursing homes, you'll see pieces in there such as the use of certain medications that aren't going to apply to your facility. So the same thing will apply on the template. There will be things that don't apply, and you can mark NA and go on. As you go through the course, you're still going to have to take that course and that training in the course, But as I read and we provide in the plan, there's detailed background on the course and how it works. We believe that any licensed healthcare professional can successfully complete the course. The and as I mentioned, the assessments are to be performed or updated on or after the issuance of the plan. That's to account for the latest guidance and your approaches to doing visitation, communal dining, outings, et cetera. So all of that, your risk assessment takes into account kind of, all right, here's what we want to do and here's what we're going to do to minimize the risk, et cetera. Those first two parts of the plan are followed by the third part of the plan, which is this specific template that's provided for nursing facilities that has a phase one, phase two, phase three. We are aware of a couple of things that we're going to need to issue some clarification on. We're working on that. And there will be a broader FAQ document issued to support a lot of the questions that have come up, that some of which I'm addressing now. But the last part of after that, you get the infection prevention appendix followed by the testing guidance, and that testing and guidance is applicable across all of the facility types. So the infection preventionist and testing guidance applies across both provider types. But a common question and clarification that I would make around testing is that the baseline testing is continuing for our non-nursing and skilled nursing facilities. And we are working on a methodology for that where our task forces, rather than our staff coming in, are working with the designated person at the facility, where we verified they have the training and skills to do the sample collection, and then coordinate with the facility to provide the sample media for swab collection and instructions on how to store those swabs and how to get them shipped back to our lab for priority processing. So we're working on that process, and that will be a process that we're also looking to perfect going forward for future outbreaks in facilities that we can move more quickly to respond to any future outbreaks by providing the media to the facility and letting the facility coordinate to get their sample collections completed. Last thing on testing I'd say is that as what it does state is that the testing so that in the testing section it provides that there's going to be testing protocols developed by facility. We ran into, as we talked about, issues with availability of testing, the cost involved with testing, the response times for testing. Those are all acknowledged by CMS and CDC in their guidance on facility testing. So this guidance specifies that protocols will be developed by the facilities for testing. We don't know what those will be for your facility. It will be based on virus prevalence in your community, your access to testing media, and access to rapid turnaround time for your tests. So those protocols that you develop for your facility will be BORs based on your circumstances and situation. Facilities will have the discretion to develop their testing protocols for residents and staff based on their infection prevention and control plan. So that might involve testing a portion of staff. I've heard some providers have suggested doing 25% a week. That will be the facility's strategy to develop what they want to do. based on their region and resources and testing availability. The last thing I want to talk about from the testing standpoint is the criteria that we identify in the plan for restricting, moving backwards in the phases, restricting visitations, et cetera. We're going to follow up with some clarification on that, and we are developing a website that will provide, I think the solution will be a website solution that provides the county-specific data. In the interim, while that's standing up, a report will be issued, probably in the form of a PDF file that we'll send out to facilities so that they'll be able to see the 7 and 14-day trend for their county. So there's still some developments being issued on that.
So, James, on that, that's the questions that we get. So they'll want to call and they'll say, hey, we haven't had any COVID for 14 days. What phase am I in? Or they want to say, well, we had one positive. Are we back to phase one? So they're trying to associate
sure.
a number in their head with what phase am I in, along with this county data that is also a prerequisite.
Okay, so anytime a facility has a COVID case, they're back at phase one.
Okay, thank you.
If we provided in the plan a link to the county data that we currently have on our website. It's been pointed out to me that my attempt to provide good instructions nevertheless failed. So when you follow that link, you will see the region. And in the map for the region, you will see the shaded counties in that region. And when you click on that county, click on your county, a little box will pop up that shows the number of cases in that county. And your next step is to click on the number of cases. That is a hyperlink. And when you click on that, it will show you a graph of the trend, the number of cases, and a trend line for the county. So it's so visually right now you can see the trend in your county. And if you obviously see a flat line or declining line over the last 2 weeks, that tells you kind of where you're going where you've been, and gives you the heads up, short of us giving you the specifics. But the data that we give you is going to reflect what you're seeing on that graph. It's just going to be explicit statement related to some measurable things that try to tie back to the language used in the plan.
Which would bring up another question. Let's say, okay, our facility's been COVID-free. We haven't had a case for 60 days. However, the county data shows an increase in COVID activity. What phase am I in?
So the way we wrote it in the plan is that you are in phase three, but if you're seeing, you would be in phase three, but because you're seeing the increased upward trends, you then have the ability to be more restrictive because you've seen these upward trends going on in your facility. And that's part of what I'm talking about us getting you some more specific, because upward trend is not precise, and you know, we need to be more precise.
I'm trying to hedge off some of the questions that would come
to
the end.
I know what you're up to over there, Mr. Cook.
So yeah, and I appreciate you not pointing out that I was the idiot that couldn't figure out how to find the trend.
Didn't have to. You did that yourself right there. All right. So the next thing that when Carter was with us, he mentioned and he described coronavirus relief funds being made available. So we are finalizing the application process for all of our long-term care provider types, you know, residential care, assisted living, ICFIIDs, and our nursing homes, my expectation is we're going to stand up a website that will have a form on it where you enter in basic information, answer some questions, upload some supporting documents, and hit submit. We're trying to simplify this as much as possible while having appropriate accounting and auditable provisions in place. The funds will be the initial information that we're getting is these funds will be for expenses from March 1st through December 30th. So that will be allow you to cover expenses related to your corona response and to this plan, and in particular your infection preventionist cost that you are incurring that are over and above what you already would have had. And I say that really in relation to our nursing homes that already have an infection preventionist person, but the additional work that they're doing would be in response to this plan. And so that would be a reimbursable expense. We are there's some questions that are being finalized. I anticipate we are going to set this thing out there for people to start applying while the final allocation methodology is still resolved. And so we will collect the applications and look at the demand for funds and work the allocation across that based on factors that we will consider will be facility type, number of residents or participants, the number of direct care staff versus staff, and other factors that I can't remember right now. I'll just leave it at that. So we're optimistic to have a soft opening for the site by Monday. There's, as a part of the application process, it will include verification. So when long-term care has signed off on your infection preventionist plans, you'll be providing us evidence that you've got the infection preventionist plan approved. So there'll be some documentation that indicates you've developed a reopening plan and that you've got your infection prevention stuff in place. So those kinds of things will be submitted as a part of your application. We're working out the details of that. If you've already because you submit your infection prevention documentation to long-term care. And so if long-term care, if you provide documentation that long-term care approved it, I don't need you to submit it again as a part of your grant application. So those are some of the issues that we're trying to work through to avoid the duplication. We've got it in one place, just affirm that it's been filed and approved, and then we'll go confirm with long-term care that it was filed and approved. I think that's as much as I've got to cover on that. And so I'll pass it back to you, Mike.
Okay. Thanks, James. I'm sure we'll have questions at the end for that. Okay. Next on our agenda is probably the most talked about topic that we have had for the last 3 months, and it's on PPE usage. And we're going to look at this in a different way. We're going to look at the environment, and so I'm going to ask Paula some questions to explain what would be going on there. And the reason that you're seeing this more and more now is now that CMS has initiated enforcement actions for level 2 deficiencies, improper use of PPE can certainly get a enforcement tag at 880 or one of the 880s for an E very easily. So we wanted to go over those. So first one is, in a COVID-negative environment, and the facility has zero cases, do we wear any PPE at all, or we just walk around however we want?
All of the staff need to have a mask on in the facility. If they're providing care to residents, they need to have a surgical mask on, unless they don't have one, but the last resort would be a cloth mask. But in providing care to those residents who are negative, they need to have that on.
So
that would be the minimum.
When you say mask, do you mean,
N95
when we're looking at residents, or can I go in and surgical mask is okay all day long?
Surgical mask. If you don't have any positive in your facility, surgical mask is fine.
Okay. So next, what would that look like in an isolated environment, and would you provide a definition of what is isolated? What do we mean by isolated?
Well, isolation really means you're using transmission precautions. And so that could be your residents who are definitely in your COVID unit. Those residents we know have COVID. And so this is kind of a complicated question because there's several different areas you would have. It could be someone who is suspected. Say you have a resident who has started showing symptoms, and either you haven't had them tested yet or you've had them tested and those results are pending. So because you really don't know what their status is, you need to use transmission-based precautions with those residents. And so what you would need to wear is preferably an N95 mask. If you don't have an N95, you can wear a surgical mask. You need to have eye protection. You need to have a gown on and gloves on when you're providing care to those residents.
So basically, in isolated, we don't know what you have, but
That's right. A
suspicion that you have COVID.
That's right.
Which case you would use full PPE if you're going in. So I'm a single resident, got my own room at the end of the hall, and the whole rest of the environment is negative. When they come into my room, they need to be in full PPE.
They need to be in full PPE unless they're just going to walk in there for a second and hand you a cup of pills, and they're not going to stay in there for any length of time. They're just going to walk back out.
Okay. So I'm suspected to have it. I need to take my pills. What's the CNA going to wear in there when she's just bringing my pills and she's going to give them to me, I'm to take them, and walk back out? What should I be wearing?
She should have her mask on and gloves if she wants to wear them.
What kind of mask, surgical or N95?
If she's going to go in and take care of you, she needs to have an N95
on. Thank you. So pretty much what we're saying is anytime you're going to come in contact with a person who is suspected to have COVID or does have COVID, you should have an N95 mask on. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, that's
okay.
A fair statement.
And the reason I'm asking them this way is because we get the questions this way, and it's the same with James and the reopening.
I understand.
That's why these come in here. Okay, so now let's talk about a quarantine environment. A quarantine environment means these people are absolutely COVID positive.
No, it does not. It means they're unknown. It means they have been out in an environment that we don't know what they have been exposed to. And so when they come back in, we have to treat them as if they may be positive, because we won't know until the end of that 14-day quarantine period, which is the incubation period for the COVID-19.
So the reason I ask that is because a lot of facilities out there think quarantine is a positive environment. So what's the difference between quarantine environment and isolated environment?
The one difference is that the isolated environment, the way that you're referring to it, you're talking about someone who's suspected, because those people have symptoms. And so they could be more likely to be positive. It could be something else, though. We don't know what it is.
So quarantine, they have symptoms.
Now,
isolated, they have symptoms.
No.
Do you see the problem?
No, quarantine doesn't have symptoms. If they had symptoms, they would be suspected.
So again, the difference between, and Janine's biting her lips.
I know she is.
So
but if
very quickly, the difference between an isolated versus quarantine.
An isolated is a person who is showing, if I really don't like the use of the word isolated.
I don't either. That's why I'm bringing this up.
Because really I would like to say that there's a difference between these two people, because you have someone who is suspected, and they're suspected because they have symptoms that could be consistent with having COVID. And that's why we have them isolated, is because they have those symptoms. A quarantine is a person who has been out in the hospital, they're new admit, they've been out in the public, they could have been exposed to anything. We don't know what they've been exposed to. They don't have symptoms yet, or they may never develop symptoms, but we will not know until the end of that quarantine period what they have.
So quarantine is a lesser degree.
Yes.
Okay.
But it still requires the use of an N95 mask, eye protection, a gown, and gloves for care. When you go into care for these residents, when you're going to be up close and personal with them, you're going to be exposed to body fluids or splashes. When you're doing things like assisting with a bath or incontinent care or toileting, or you're transferring where you're right in their face, and so you're going to be sharing germs with them, you need to have full PPE on for two reasons. One is you're protecting yourself, because you don't know what you are putting yourself in contact with. And the other thing is you are protecting your other residents, because if you go in there without a gown on and you get their germs all over you, and then you go into the next room and you don't have a gown on, you have shared everything. And so that's why we are very careful with those quarantine residents.
Okay. And then the next one is a COVID positive environment. What do we wear? And obviously this one is, yeah, we got full PPE. And the question really becomes, we have a wing and there's 10 COVID positive on it. What do I wear to visit each one? Say, I'm going to make the rounds and I'm going to visit all 10 of them. The question is, you know, sometimes it comes as, well, we wear the same gown, or we wear the same face shield, or we wear the same mask, or the same gloves, or some say, oh, we just wear cloth masks. They get mixed up between them. And this is the most restrictive environment of all of them.
When you're in a COVID-positive unit, you have residents all in that unit that have COVID. You don't have people in there that have MRSA or... Well, you might, but then you're going to have to designate that you do. But if all you have in there is COVID-positive residents, then you can use extended wear for some of your PPE. So say you're going to go provide care. When you go in to see that resident, you're going to put on your gown, your gloves, your mask, your eye protection, and you're going to take care of that resident. And then you're going to remove your gloves and wash your hands. If your gown is not soiled and your face shield and your mask, then you can wear that to the next positive resident. And you can continue on throughout your rounds that you're doing in that unit, and then you need to discard your gown. You need to clean your face shield, because those are cleanable.
And if I'm done with five of them and somebody down here that's negative, just needs their meds, can I run in there real quick and give them their meds?
Preferably you wouldn't, because hopefully what we're going to do is cohort those residents who are positive in an area. Ideally, that would be on their own hall, in a unit, and if you can separate it physically, that's even better. But what you really want to think about doing is having dedicated staff that only work down on that unit and only care for those residents.
And I'm glad you mentioned it, because it comes to the next environment. What is a cohorting environment?
It means that you have looked at your resident population, and if you have residents who are COVID positive, that you cohort those residents down on a hall or a wing or an area of the building where they're segregated from the other residents. And if there's a physical separation that you can put in place, like double doors, that's even better. And then for your residents who are quarantined, it's also good if you can put them in their own area and have separate staff to care for them as well.
And to go through that brings me to, here's where we're seeing the deficiency. We're short on PPE. We're going into COVID-positive environments, and we don't change the gown, or we don't change the gloves, or we don't change the mask, we don't have a face shield. So those are the kind of things that are going to get an F-tag for infection control, right?
Yes, those are going to get.
And is that what we're indeed seeing when we're citing these deficiencies?
We're seeing that. One of the biggest problems that we're seeing right now is a misunderstanding of residents who are in quarantine that, first of all, that they have an unknown status. Because we've asked the hospitals to do a test before those residents leave the hospital and they get a negative test, some facilities are assuming that means the resident is negative. But one negative test in that time frame does not tell you that they're going to stay negative, that they didn't contract the illness while they were there and it just hasn't manifested itself enough, or they don't have a high enough viral load that the test turned positive. That's why we have to monitor them for those full 14 days. That's why we have to use PPE to protect ourselves, the healthcare provider, and the other residents in the facility.
Okay. Which brings me to, I was trying to figure out how I was going to say this. In the instance that, well, I'm going to say this. So I think that fairly covers it. What I wanted our callers to understand was what deficiencies are being written and why. And the biggest part of what we're seeing is improper use of PPE, correct? And what you mentioned.
That is the biggest thing. That's not all we're seeing, but that's the biggest thing.
Okay. Anything you want to add?
I do want to add that we're going to create a matrix that will clarify it, hopefully, that will define easier at just at a glance of what type of PPE you need to have on for each situation.
Okay. Well, thank you, Paula. I appreciate your insight and answering. I think as, you know, we move on, that is one thing, you know, when we were doing our provider trainings, people always want to know what are the top 10 deficiencies. So I think that we're going to make this an active part of our call to say what we're seeing as far as deficiencies and why we're seeing them. And right now, with the enforcement actions for nursing homes being kind of reinvented, they're circling around infection control. So thank you. Appreciate it. Next on our next up is our civil monetary penalty reinvestment fund update. Hold on just a minute, and I am going to get our caller on. Hold on. So like I said, next up is our civil monetary penalty reinvestment fund update. Hey, Lisa, would you turn off your speaker to the conference? You're getting feedback because of that.
Okay.
And Lisa Connor is going to talk about infection control practices as it relates to communication technology devices. Go ahead, Lisa.
Is that better?
That sounds good to me.
Okay, thank you. All right, hello, my name is Lisa Connor, and as Mike said, I am the Civil Monetary. I'm with the Civil Monetary Penalty Program, and I'm the nurse manager with the Oklahoma State Department of Health. And today I just wanted to address the importance of proper infection control practices, as some of you all are starting to receive approval letters for your communicative technology devices. We just really wanted to ensure that some of you all are, well, all of you all are having proper infection control practices with those communicative technology devices. So I just briefly wanted to take a little bit of time and go through that with you. So with that, of course, with any procedure, we just want to start with proper hand hygiene. So first, we just, of course, would wash hands and cover all areas for 20 seconds, and or you could use an alcohol-based hand rub that is 60% ethanol or 70% isopropanolol. And then next, you would don gloves or consider eye protection, because then we're going to clean the communicative device. You would then want to refer to the EPA List N for proper products to clean and disinfect the communicative technology device. To find that EPA List N, simply just Google the EPA List N. The EPA List N is not specific to COVID-19. It is for guidance on the pathogenic virus, SARS-CoV-2. If the product has a human coronavirus claim, it could be used in place of the emerging pathogen claim if that is the only alternative. It is recommended to use a cover for the communicative device. This will help to provide safety against drops and scratches, and it provides the ability to really clean the device without damaging it. And then make sure to please read the manufacturer's guidelines for cleaning the device that your nursing facility is using. If there is no specific manufacturer guidelines, according to the CDC, alcohol-based wipes or sprays containing at least 70% alcohol is acceptable. And then please ensure that the device is allowed to dry thoroughly. Always ensure that cleaning the device is done before and after it is used with each resident. Then you're going to remove your gloves and dispose of them accordingly and ensure proper hand hygiene procedure again. PPE should be worn when using a communicative device with residents that require transmission-based precautions, and this would be those residents that are known or suspected to have COVID-19, C. diff, MRSA, or VRE. After using the technology device with the resident, you again remove your PPE, discard it accordingly, and then again ensure proper hand hygiene procedure. We would then again clean your communicative device thoroughly after using it with the resident, and then from there follow the proper product contact time according to the EPA List N. This is the length of time that is shown to properly inactivate the virus to allow for disinfection. Allow the device to thoroughly air dry, and then if the contact time has not been met, it would be important to re-clean the device. And then last, if you're not going to use the device for another resident, please place the device in the designated locked area. So that's really it for my presentation. If anybody would have any questions, you would want to email myself or Lavetta Abdullah. She's the program manager. I believe she presented last week, and she may have an update for you all today. But you could email us at cmp@health.ok.gov. That's all I have. I really appreciate you all letting me present over this. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Lisa. We appreciate it. Lavetta, do you have anything you'd like to add since you're here with us?
Yes, I'll just give another application processing update. And thank you, Lisa, for the presentation.
Thanks, Lisa.
Thank you. Thanks.
Okay, so as of June the 16th, we received 83 applications. Those 83 applications represents 159 facilities. Last week we had 61 applications. As of June the 16th, the application reviewed are 64 of the 83 received. That represents 101 facilities. That's about about one-third of the eligible facilities. Not reviewed, 19 of the 83 applications have not been reviewed. Most of those was received within the last week. And pending, meaning we reviewed them, but we need additional information, 7 of the 83 applications received have missing information. The number one missing information is the CMS certification number, also known as CCN. Some people call it a Medicare or Medicaid number. A lot of people are giving us a state-issued number, I guess an NH number. And also the second missing information would be the cover letter. And we're checking that up front. Previously, we would file it, and when we got to your application, we checked. But we're trying to check that up front now and send you a letter immediately. And so in conclusion, about 53% of the facilities have asked for communication technologies. And that's all I have for today. Thank you.
Thanks, Lavetta. We appreciate it. Next on our agenda is the CMS QINQIO, who is Telegen update, and Sherry Longacre is here to provide us that update. How are you, Sherry?
Hi, Mike. Thank you for having me today. Can everyone hear me okay?
We're good.
Perfect. So just to kind of recap, so my name is Sherry Longacre, and I'm a Senior Quality Improvement Facilitator at Telegen. And as many of you know, Telegen is the QIO, QIM for the state of Oklahoma, Illinois, Colorado, and Iowa. And we do provide assistance at no cost and resources for quality improvement. And we cover such topics as, of course, we're focused right now on infection prevention and five-star readmissions and CASPER data. There are multiple resources that we have at our fingertips. This service is paid up front through the Social Security Act, so there is no cost involved with partnering with Telegen at our website, telegenqinqio.com. Now, as many of you know, we've received our new directives from CMS, and we've shifted this focus to quality improvement initiatives, which we call the QII referrals. And through CMS's own internal processes, they are identifying nursing homes that need additional assistance with their infection prevention and control programs. And Telegen is one of 12 quality improvement organizations that CMS has contracted to work with approximately 3,000 nursing homes nationwide. So we're receiving those referrals every Friday from CMS. And if we reach out, please know we're here to assist and help with you as we work through those processes. CMS referrals are time sensitive, and the QII plan must be completed and submitted to CMS within 30 days of the referral. It's been a pleasure collaborating with Janine Kitts at the Oklahoma State Department of Health, and we are identifying promising practices and resources to share with our nursing homes as we work through the QII process.
So, Sherry, quick question. If I'm an assisted living...
I'm sorry, excuse me?
I have a quick question. So, if I have assisted living building, can I give you a call?
Yes, we are working with all of our healthcare entities throughout the state. So, all healthcare entities.
Are you working with assisted living facilities and nursing homes?
So these QII referrals are just specifically to nursing homes throughout the state. However, if you are assisted living and you're needing resources for your infection prevention and control program, reach out. We are definitely here to help support you too.
Awesome.
Yes. We're also, we have been providing NHS Gen support and assistance, which is pressing for everyone right now. So if you're unable to report or get access to NHS Gen, please reach out and we can help get you up and running on that. We received a ton of phone calls after the call last week on this call, and we certainly try to provide technical assistance and help walk you through the process. Now, of course, there are some things we can help with and some things that we cannot. But because Telegen was on the QIN project, the CMS project on the last scope of work, we have definitely have strong NHSN background and assistance that we can give. So we've really been fielding those calls and helping. So I'm going to share my email address with you, and it is slongacre@telegen.com, and that is slongacre@telegen.com. And I would like to share with you one thing that has come to my attention is that CMS is sending the penalty notification letters to the key system. So make sure you're checking there when you're looking for those. I would love to connect with you. We are trying to reach out to all of our healthcare and long-term care facilities throughout the state of Oklahoma, so please connect with me, and I can get you registered with our Telegen QI Connect. That's kind of our portal in ways that we can communicate you and provide assistance with you. And just one more little shout out is that our long-term care office hours are this Thursday, June 18th, and we'll be having a special guest speaker, Alice Bonner from the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, and she'll be showing you how to incorporate evidence-based age-friendly health system framework into your organization and also describing the weekday National Nursing Home Huddle. So please join us. If you'd like to register on that, go to the telegenqinqio.com, and on the far right-hand side, it has upcoming events for registration information. Please reach out to me. I'm here to help. With all of your problems, bring them to me. And my office number is 405-810-3224. I look forward to connecting with you, and anything I can help, please let me know. Thank you, Mike.
Sherry, this is James Johnson. You referenced the office hours. Is that a webinar that you do, and how can folks access that?
So the office hours, we have statewide office hours, and then we also have that we have for post-acute office hours, and then we also have our long-term care specific office hours, and they can connect with us by going to, if they are registered with Telegen, then they automatically receive that registration form for that. And if they are not, then I would encourage you to please come register with us so that you can receive that information, or go to telegenqinqio.com, and then on the far right-hand side on the upcoming events, it has their registration event, all the event information and registration for those events.
Thank you.
I'll give you a shout-out, too, Sherry. If you haven't been on a call or been to a convention with Alice Bonner, I highly recommend it. She is a wealth of knowledge. She worked for CMS Baltimore for many, many years, and she just has a wealth of nursing home knowledge. So, Sherry, thanks so much. We appreciate the update.
Thank you, Mike. Have a great day, everyone.
You too. Which leads me into our operations and exactly the first item that we need to talk about, which is the National Healthcare Safety Network. This is the network set up on CDC and in association with CMS, and this is where you are supposed to be reporting nationally, nursing homes reporting nationally for positive cases. This started back May the 8th and had several deadlines. What I do want to tell you is we did a call with the CMS regional office. This was a priority that they talked about. None of the states in Region 6 are at 100%. So the facilities are the one that report this data. So they wanted me to reach out to you and say, be sure to report, because the system is now automatically issuing citations for failure to report. And so what it is, you have to report at least once every 7 days. You can report anytime you want. You can report more than once. But you need to be reporting at least every 7 days. And if you're having issues with that, I recommend that you reach out to the QIO for assistance. They've helped a number of facilities, and they'll be able to guide you along and get you up to speed so that we're not seeing any enforcement actions on this. So those enforcement actions are not coming out of the state agency. Those are coming directly from CMS Baltimore. On our COVID-focused surveys, we continue to get those done. Actually, right now, we have done a COVID-focused survey on any facility that has had a death or even one positive. So now we're going out to facilities that have zero cases. Just to remind you, we have to go through every single nursing home and provide a COVID-focused survey by July 31st. We're on track to meet that right now. And in addition, I also want to let the assisted livings know that as we see assisted livings with a death or a positive case, we are doing a COVID-focused survey on those. So be aware of that. I'm not absolutely sure the federal is continuing with their surveys in Oklahoma. I didn't get a list this week, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're not still doing it. So you could get the state agency, or you could get the federal office out of Dallas also doing these. Infection control consults. I can't tell you enough. If you don't know, you know, obviously your infection preventionist ought to be able to set you up with this, but we're still available. You know, you can call us. We'll be glad to help. I know Janine and her staff are absolutely ready to help, but we need to make sure that you're following the regulatory guidelines, because once you get cited at a level 2, which is a D, E, or F, and in the event that we have to come out and you get cited again, CMPs will kick in on a level 2 deficiency once you've been cited at level 2. Obviously, for actual harm and immediate jeopardy, those are immediate civil monetary penalties. So make sure that you're following CMS and CDC's infection prevention reporting requirements. Obviously, you still need to be reporting through your facility report incidents to us, as well as to acute disease whenever you have a suspected case of COVID. That is all of our topics. I want to make sure, James, you got anything else before we go into questions?
Yeah, I do want to give one update. I had an email follow-up. So I referenced the link to the county trend data. That link is in Appendix B of the plan. So there's a link to the plan in your agenda. Go to the last page, the last paragraph. It has a link to that county data.
Thank you. Paula? Jean? Okay, so we're going to move into our Q&A. And Pam, would you tell us how that works?
Yes, you should be prompted. You'll press 10, your calls will be taken in order, and it should prompt you. There is a few seconds delay, and we'll start that now.
And if I want to ask just a question, what do I punch?
10. 10.
This conference is now in question and answer mode. To alert the speaker that you have a question, press 10.
10. They're coming in. So before we have that, I have a question that I got just before we came in here. And the question is, with the increase in testing, won't the number of positive cases keep going up? You know, we look at the nursing home data every day. I'm really shocked at how much it really hasn't dramatically gone up. It is going up as we do the testing a little bit, but not like I thought it would.
So there's two elements to testing. There's the actual case rates, and then there's the positive cases that are positive as a percentage of the total number of tests. So as the total number of tests testing done goes up, we're looking to see, you know, what's going on with that percentage. But separately, we're looking at the actual number of cases. So there's two elements to that.
So you could actually see a downward trend even though you're having positive cases.
You could see a downward trend in the percentage of cases that are positive as a percentage of the total number of tests. So that goes back to why we said, let's take another look at and get a little better guidance for everybody on those testing metrics because of those pieces.
Well, that gets us going. Don't go anywhere, James. I'm sure we have more questions to come. Question one. Caller, are you there? Go ahead, caller.
Okay, after, if I send a resident to the doctor and they return just for a routine doctor's visit, do I need to call in and report them as a suspected case just because they went to the doctor?
So let's set this up before you get the answer. I'm not going to be the answer. So when you went to the doctor, did you have a health professional that escorted them there?
Correct.
Did you have to wait in the waiting room, and were anybody in the waiting room that you didn't know? It's all about being able to control the environment. So if you go and have a health professional that's wearing masks and knows everything to watch for, and you're in a lobby with nobody there, I'll let them answer that one.
Well, the first thing is they wouldn't be suspected just because they went to the doctor. The probably the issue is, would they need to be in quarantine? So what we're saying is, if you have a controlled environment that you transported the resident, you went with them, you knew who they came in contact with, that everyone was following safe procedures, they had masks on, they weren't in a crowded room, everybody's washing their hands, then we're saying in that situation, no, you would not need to quarantine them. But if
so we can
don't
just question
the
person I sent, the healthcare professional I sent with them. Part two of my question, we are currently wearing full PPE and N95 mask when they come back from the doctor when we quarantine them. Is that what I'm supposed to do, or am I doing overkill with the N95 and the full PPE with just them being quarantined because they went to the doctor?
So going to the doctor is not it. So in the first question you asked, the scenario was the environment was completely controlled and that lobby was not full and you were not around any suspected cases. Is that still the same scenario we come back?
Yes, if we had a waiting room full of coughing, sick people, then yes, we would go ahead and consider and do full quarantine and call it suspected. But if it was easy, no issues at the doctor, they come back, they return, do I need to wear full PPE just because they're quarantined for because they went to the doctor?
If you went to the doctor and everything was good, you sent someone with them, everyone was wearing a mask, there wasn't a waiting room full of people, everything was good, you don't need to quarantine them, so you don't need to have full PPE on. But if you took them out and it wasn't controlled, you don't know what the situation was, or you went and you saw it was bad, then they need to be quarantined, and then, yes, you would need to have your full PPE on.
So if they come back from a hospital stay of, you know, 2 or 3 days, then we would wear our full PPE quarantine prevention, N95, everything, if they've been at the hospital. But the doctor depends on the symptoms at the doctor or what happened at the doctor's visit.
If at the hospital, all they're around are healthcare professionals, no. Go ahead, James.
Just a moment.
we just don't want to waste PPE is what we're saying. We just want to be clarified. We have 100% negative cases at this time, knock on wood. We want to keep it that way. Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm assuming this would be someone that is in phase one.
Okay.
That, did we answer, caller? Did we get your questions answered?
I believe so. What I'm taking from this is if we feel, if they were at the hospital and they come back for 14 days quarantine, I do not necessarily need to wear. Okay. Okay, yes, we're good. Thank you.
Okay. No, because you're saying you're putting them in quarantine.
For 14 days after they've been in the hospital or after they go on a doctor's visit, we are not quarantining them for 14 days, yes. Monitor them for signs and symptoms of since they've been out into the public.
I think we're confusing this a little bit because we're talking about two different situations, which are different situations. We're talking about going to the doctor, which is under a controlled situation where you're going with them, you know what the situation is, you know everything was done correctly. We're saying that doesn't have to be quarantined.
Okay.
If you don't know the situation, it would be. If they go to the hospital, you're not there with them, they're quarantined when they come back.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a good question. Glad you asked.
Thank you. Go ahead, caller.
Hi. Good afternoon. Can you please clarify, as we move into phase one, we have zero COVID in the community. For any new admissions coming in, what is their quarantine period to make sure they've got no signs or symptoms? Is it 10 days or 14 days?
For a new admission?
Yeah.
At phase one.
14 days.
Phase one. Thank you.
And it's going to be 14 days in phase two and in phase three.
Perfect.
I'm going to add something to your question because we get it all the time. When they left the hospital, they had a test and they were negative. Are we good? They don't have to quarantine?
No. That really doesn't mean anything. It means the day they took the test, they were negative.
Okay, you said no, and I want to clarify. You weren't saying no, they don't have to quarantine.
Correct. They do have to quarantine. The negative test does not matter. The
negative test does not determine that we don't have to have someone quarantine.
So whether they have a test, no test, or five tests, they need to quarantine for 14 days.
Yes, and then if you want to test them at the end of the 14 days, just to verify they're negative, you can. But you have to wait that incubation period.
Okay. Thank you. We get that one. Go ahead, caller.
Yeah, could you just clarify for me, I heard that we have to have a licensed health professional, like our licensed infection preventist, make a plan, and it has to include the risk assessment, the monitoring plan when we open, and send it to the health department. Am I missing something? I thought there was three pieces.
Oh, now you got me pulling my notes back out.
Sorry.
No, it's you. See, so what it says is you identify to us the person. So that's part of what it is. Name, phone number, email, the person, your infection preventionist. So they have to do that and then provide to us who that is and their risk assessment. And that risk assessment is going to cover these items that we're going to check off. And then the biweekly performance monitoring plan is a part of that.
Okay, so I did get it all. All right. And
so that's pages 2 and 3 covered in numbers 1 through 5 of the plan.
Okay. And these are due before we can open to you to get approved, correct?
So there is That's one way to approach this, is just to get this done and nail this down. The plan does not say you cannot do any reopening activity until you get this done.
Okay. Now, on the news, it said something about my other part of the question. All the families are saying that we are opening 28 days after the last positive person is negative, blah, 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 blah. Is that correct? Does that have anything to do with it?
No, the facility, no, and we issued guidance. The facilities are now working on their reopening plans now that they have a plan. All right. So they're working from this to develop their reopening plans. They have up to 4 weeks for the infection preventionists to submit their monitoring plan, but their reopening plan is theirs based on their own community transmission, whether they had COVID in there in the past, what's going on in their county. So the facility is not, this is the day I'm reopened. It's, all right, now I've got to, given that I have this guidance, let me do my assessment and figure out what's a safe approach that I can accommodate given all the various factors that we identify in those plans that relate to what you can do, which include your access to PPE, the level of transmission in your community, all of those different things.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Go ahead, caller.
Yes, I was just wanting to confirm, is the N95 fit testing required?
So, you're asking about OSHA compliance, and under OSHA requirements for certain health professions, that would be something that you would do to protect your employees. Janine, okay. You want to add something more on that?
Depending on your setting, historically long-term care has never been required to have a respiratory protection program. OSHA guides that in the process of that program and what it looks like. CDC changed their verbiage to say you could consider to now you should. So they're recommending to have a respiratory protection program. Then once that is in place, that is what you determine is who is required to be fit tested. A majority of those would be your frontline staff that truly provides care and should not include everyone in your building. It should only include your clinicians.
I want to add on that, too, that and you'll see in the guidance that it says if you've got fit-tested N95, wear that. And if you don't, Janine, I think it says wear a surgical mask. What we have been doing, because providers have been trying to go out and get their staff fit-tested and have had problems getting vendors, so we've taken the step of we have a contractor that will go to facilities that haven't been able to get a group of staff fit tested and provide that. And then we are working on a contract. We've got a pending contract to provide fit test kits to our facilities, to all of our facilities. Our intent is to provide fit test kits so that you have the ability to do fit testing for your staff based on, you know, your matrix and infection prevention and control plan.
Okay. And I do also have one more question. So whenever, you know, we had gotten, it had said that we could, you know, do the test within 48 hours prior to discharge from the hospital, and then you could do a second test after they come. Is that required or is that optional?
There's no requirement to do a second test once they get your facility.
Okay, so
what's required is a 14-day quarantine.
And so I was reporting, you know, sending all of that to, you know, to y'all, and then also calling acute disease, I mean, for all of that. So that is not a requirement.
The requirement, as James said, is 14-day quarantine. Whether you do zero test or five tests does not supersede the 14-day quarantine.
Correct. Okay. And so whenever I have, like, a quarantine, no positives, but I have, you know, my quarantine population, when I had one of the state surveyors come out to my facility, she had said that we could use washable gowns in those rooms. But the last couple of phone calls that I've heard with y'all, I'm hearing that that is incorrect. Is that right?
I would think you would want to wear the disposable gowns, especially if you're going to do something like assisted bathing or have splashes or something like that.
What if they have?
If you absolutely had to, like you had no gowns, you could. But
what if they have 100 washable gowns and they change them every time they go from one room to another?
That's what we've been doing, and then we have just, you know, a small amount of disposable gowns that we, you know, have been saving those for, you know, if we do get a positive, you know what I mean? So
when you refer to cloth gowns, are you referring to, like, the actual PPE cloth gowns, or are you referring to, like, an alternative, like the resident gowns?
We purchased hospital gowns that we that have a different design that are just used by our staff, but they are just hospital gowns.
So if they were rated as PPE, that is fine. But again, anything that is not, to not get into a huge ordeal, AMI rated gowns that are truly impervious when you're going to bathe or shower or something that's going to be a wet, a truly wet activity, you would want something that protects you a little more. But this is being used for contact precautions, which typically, if you're COVID positive, it's about the contact that you can pick something up and take it to someone else. It is not about blood and body fluid splashing everywhere that you need to protect yourself. So always look at the task at hand and what type of PPE you need. Cloth gowns should be fine, but again, look at the activity. Does that help?
Okay. Yes, that does help. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So I am going to let you know that there are a lot of questions. We will stay here and answer these questions. Are you fine with that, James? We will stay here and answer the questions today, but we will be going past 2:30. So, caller, go ahead.
Okay, I've just got a couple of questions. On the infection preventionist, do they have dedicated hour requirements per week, and can they be a current licensed staff member, or do they have to have, like, this has to be their only duty?
Okay, so no, there's no hour requirements. They can be current staff.
They can have multiple duties.
And they can have multiple duties.
Okay. The GN95 mask versus the N95. What is the protocol on that? Because we don't have true N95s. We have the KNs and the GNs.
I know what I've heard. You know for sure, Janine?
Well, I've heard a number of conversations.
Okay.
OSHA did set forth fit testing recommendations for KN95. However, some of the contracted folks will not fit test you for KN95 because there is a high failure rate of the fit test. Although they are 99.9% or 95, whatever that percentage is that they are tested and validated for, may be in place. But if it's an improper fit, it's not going to protect you any different because air will go around, follows the path of least resistance. The GN95s, I have seen or heard no information regarding those. I do understand that the RMRS folks have kind of sent N95s and KN95s out, so I'm not sure the source of your GN95s are.
They're also from our Merck.
Okay, and I'm not, I don't know about that, but I do know that they were balanced, trying to balance the N95s and KN95s.
Okay, so I'll just contact, we're already set up for our fit testing, so I will contact the company and see if they're going to be agreeable to use the GN95s that they sent us.
Your notice that you get on that specifies the issue in that email. We really try to highlight that. So if you're coming out, if we're coming out from fit testing, talk to the Merck. Make sure that you've got some we will set you up with some N95s for your testing purposes.
Okay. And then the last question I had, she was talking about if they go out for physician's visits, they don't, and it's kind of a supervised controlled visit. On the paperwork you guys put out, it says they have to quarantine for 14 days upon return if asymptomatic. But she was saying they don't have to if it's a controlled environment. So I just want to make sure that once we get to that point, if we do it in a controlled environment, that we're not going to get in trouble for not quarantining for 14 days, since that's what it says in the bullet you guys put out.
What bullets are you talking about?
It says phase reopening in long-term care facilities. If you go to page 7, the second line from the bottom, it says quarantine for 14 days upon return if asymptomatic. And if you go above the little bullets, it says for medically necessary trips away from the facility, and it tells you the requirements.
Okay, let us take a look. That's in the phase 2 discussion, and we'll take a look at this to see if, as I mentioned, we've caught a few of these. But remember that the guidance that we're offering is for if it's a very controlled environment where you've got full supervision in place. But we'll take a look at that.
Okay. I think that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, good afternoon. I have a couple of questions related to the rollout plan. The first one is, I'd just like a clear definition of quarantine. I want to make sure, because quarantine for our organization, the resident can still leave their apartment. And I just want to double check and make sure what your definition of quarantine is.
I'll tell you what, when we do the matrix, we will make a note to put that definition on there. How's that?
That's perfect.
Because there are others that have that same question. That's why we brought it up.
Okay, thank you. And then my second part of the question, with the rollout plan, am I understanding correctly that if our organization already has a plan in play that resembles this but doesn't match this exactly, that's okay?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. That's all. Those are all my questions.
Thank you. Go ahead, caller.
Yes, my question is a clarification on our quarantine rooms. We are a non-COVID-free building. On our quarantine rooms, if the staff has to wear an N95 mask or whether it can be surgical with a face shield. And the reason I'm asking is we have fit tested, but we don't have enough of the needed masks for everybody to wear the right N95 mask.
So if you don't have enough of the N95, you can wear a surgical mask with your face shield.
Okay, thank you.
I would recommend and tag on to that, prioritize those for the ones that are right in the resident's face providing care. It doesn't necessarily need to be someone going in to pass a medication or deliver a meal tray or something like that. Restrict it to those intimate contacts that can occur between the provider and the resident.
And I'll add to it, if you need PPE, make sure to contact your RMRS and let them know.
All right. Thank you for that.
Uh-huh. Go ahead, caller. Caller? Star 6?
Hello?
Go ahead.
Try it again.
Try it again. So, hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Thanks.
I've actually already had my question answered, so thank you guys.
Thank you. Next. Go ahead, caller.
Hi there. I've got two questions, please. Are you able to hear me?
I can. Go right ahead.
Okay. In the phased reopening in long-term care facilities packet that you sent out, number 4 on the third page speaks of biweekly performance monitoring by the IP. When you say biweekly, do you mean twice a week?
Oh, yes. Yes, thank you for asking that. Twice every 2 weeks.
Once, so twice per month?
Yeah.
Okay, and then if the IP is off campus, are you able to monitor through internet or scanned items, or does the IP need to be in the facility to monitor?
So here's what you want in place is a monitoring process, and there are some forms that we're going to provide. We want people in the facility monitoring. The infection preventionist, in effect, is monitoring the monitoring. So they would be doing their own monitoring as well, but part of their role is to look at, is the facility, does they have a system in place where the administrator or someone else is periodically going around and checking to make sure things and documenting that that's being done. They're looking at that monitoring of the monitoring, if you will.
And then they are sending that?
Well, they don't have to send it. That's sampling. We're not asking facilities to send all their monitoring. We're going to sample that. So we might contact the infection prevention and say, hey, your number came up. Can send us your monitoring reports for the last 2 weeks.
Okay. So just
later monitor. Yeah. Okay?
Okay. That sounds good. Second question, please. As far as COVID testing, what's the status on the saliva testing versus nasal swab testing?
So we have, we've now moved.
Carol says she knew.
Oh, okay. Go ahead, Carol.
Oh, no. If you already know.
Go ahead. Oh.
Bye.
No.
Both of you guys.
You. All right, I'll begin with mine and then you can add on. So I understand that we have a new saliva vendor that we're working with, and we're getting there, or are we there?
So at the moment, the new vendor, in order to be approved, has to come back with 40 approved tests.
Yeah.
As soon as those positive tests come back, along with the positive NPs to prove that it is a true positive, then we can move along with that saliva vendor and continue doing saliva tests. But until then, we are going to have to continue on.
But what we are continuing on with is an anterior nares test. So it's a mid-turbinate swab that and Janine's going to clarify what I'm clarifying here. So it's not the deep probe. There's the ability to use the swipes within the nostrils, a centimeter to 2 centimeters. There's 2 different variations on that that mid-turbinate that I was reading about. But it's not invasive like the others were, and much easier to process, much less risk of aspiration, and therefore creates a lower demand on PPE use when collecting the sample. Go ahead, Janine. Never mind.
You don't want to get in on this?
I guess I covered enough of it.
Right.
I was close enough around the edges so she didn't feel the need to there's actually a nice little CDC has a document on that interior nares test and its procedures and kind of hitting at what I just covered. Go ahead, caller.
I wanted to clarify. You had talked about how most facilities would
start in phase three, and we have been COVID-free, thankfully, the entire time, but we're located in Tulsa County, which has an upward trend in cases. So would that put us at phase one?
So at this point, I'm going to say potentially yes, and Tulsa County is going to look very carefully. As I mentioned, we're working on issuing a report with the county specifics, but certainly Tulsa County is not going in the direction for reopening at this time.
Okay, and just a second question. I know you talk about the number of cases, but also the percentage of positivity in those cases with the testing. We had asked the Tulsa Health Department, you know, how to find that number, and they said that's not something they track, so we weren't sure where we would find that.
Okay, so, yeah, so that goes back to, so we're going to issue a refinement on these criteria around the counties that is easier to understand for everybody. And we're working on that. I think we'll have the website up by, they sound like mid-next week. So in the interim, we're going to issue a report for everybody. We're working on that. I've got a follow-up meeting on that in the morning.
Thank you.
Go ahead, caller. Go ahead. Next. Go ahead, caller.
Yes, I have some questions on testing. Initially, they had talked about testing after they had all of the nursing home residents and staff tested, blanket tested, that we were going to be testing staff once a week in an effort to basically to save lives. And I'm not hearing anything about that. And then also, do you have plans for that in the future? And in addition to that, with the upward rise of cases that we're seeing in Oklahoma, is that going to play a part in deciding what kind of testing that we're going to do or be required to do? And then also, who's going to pay for that testing?
So I hear four questions there. Let's take the first one.
Well, I'm going to tell you is just kind of what we talked about is that we've got to build out testing capacity, and so that's an issue, and that's what our Deputy Secretary Carter Kimball talked about when he spoke to the group, is that CMS recommended weekly testing, and it was a recommendation, and it talked about that's going to be decided by the states based on their resources and testing capacity. That guidance said this relies on quick turnaround of the test results and being able to turn them around in 48 hours. We have limitations on our ability to do that as we increase the volume of tests. So we've set that aside for now to come up with, all right, here's our response to do the baseline testing. It's continuing in, we've completed the nursing homes, now we're moving on to our assisted living residential care. And then the other one is having the quick response posture for any positive case in a facility to then come back in and do the full facility-wide testing in those facilities. So we, separate from that is the screening program and testing programs that the facilities are going to stand up, through their protocols and the COVID coronavirus relief funds will make funds available for the testing protocols that they develop as well.
Okay, so what I'm hearing is that the reason how come that hasn't been implemented is because we don't have the testing capacity to be able to do that just yet. And also when we do have that testing capacity, that's something that you think is going to be done and then it will be paid for by the funds that you receive. Because my opinion is the number one thing that we can do to protect our residents in long-term care is to do adequate testing. Other measures are...
And we'll continue to monitor and look at that. Thanks for your call. Go ahead, caller.
I have a couple of questions. One, I called the State Health Department and got a hold of someone, and they told me there was no such person that comes out and does the infection control consulting. Is that true?
If you will call us at 405-271-6868, we'll be glad to set you up and get an infection control consult scheduled.
Okay, that's who I did call. That is the number I called, but I'll call again. Should I ask for anybody in particular?
So you can contact the HAI program. It's Janine. It's me. My number is 405-271-4060.
Okay, thank you. And then another question, what about new employees that are coming to work, you know, after we've done our COVID testing? Do we need to be sending them for COVID testing?
Yeah, so it goes back to your infection prevention and control plan. That's part of what you want to address is how you're going to set that up, and maybe as a part of the screening process, you send them to a local county for testing, or you're doing that yourself. So those are good questions to be addressed in your infection prevention and control plan.
Okay.
All right. Go ahead, caller.
Yes, I do got a question. When we start opening up and letting visitors in, I wanted to find out about getting like these raincoats that are fully around them. That way we can disinfect them and stuff and let them dry before the next visitor comes in. And then if we could let them reuse their mask and put it in a baggie for them and just have our name on it so they only use that mask for when they come into the facility. That way we're not going through our PPE that we need for the staff, for the residents.
So it's hard for us to understand the full scope of what's being proposed here, but that would be something that, you know, as your infection preventionist evaluates, they can certainly call Janine there in acute disease and discuss that with her and kind of fill her out on the whole scenario, and we can give you some more detailed feedback on that.
Okay. And then the next part, what the last caller said about when we have new employees and sending them off for testing, I did not see that anywhere that we had to do that. So it's up to the infection control, our policy and procedure, and what we send to the state, correct?
So I don't remember exactly where that how that's covered in the infection prevention control risk assessment and planning document. So,
because that's going to be like our visitors, when they come in, do we need to make sure they get tested?
No, there's no standard for testing visitors when they come in.
All right.
I think some have contemplated trying to do that with some rapid tests, but there's no requirement to do that.
Okay, and so I did not see any requirement once we got our baseline testing that we had to test new employees on an ongoing basis.
That goes back to the facilities and working out what they want to do. There's not a specific requirement for that. Some facilities want to do that and are looking at different approaches to doing that.
All right, thank you so much.
Go ahead, caller. Go ahead. Next. So I'm going to say that we're not taking any more questions. We're going to answer what we have.
Hello.
We will go with this caller. Go ahead.
Yes. One of my questions is already answered, I think, about the quarantine. But my next thing was I had asked a question last week about skilled. I know that they had talked about not requiring the 3 midnight stay, but do they have to have some type of hospitalization in the last 30 days? And I did email y'all, but I didn't see that I got anything back.
Yeah, so our information is that people are direct admitting to some of our facilities now and bypassing the hospital. We're not the finance people, so Novitas might be your resource on that.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead, caller.
Hi, my question is, when we send a resident out for dialysis, when they come back, just like, and then we send any other resident out for a regular doctor's appointment, are we required to quarantine them for 14 days? And then I have a second question.
So with all of that, it depends on the environment, whether it was controlled or not.
So, you know, and this question has come up for 3 weeks in a row now, or 4 or 5.
Yeah.
So when we do this matrix, we cover the PPE in the different settings and the quarantine. Let's go ahead and put the dialysis in there.
Okay. We can do that.
Okay. And then my next question is, this dialysis patient is also a smoker.
Well, and that was one of the very things that Janine pointed out to us, is that we saw that, you know, the reality of and what we're trying to address is the reality of the situations facilities face in the hallway, you know, with this resident who smokes, the rooms that don't have bathrooms. And so the resident's coming out of their room to go to the bathroom or, you know, or needs dining assistance, you know, whatever that may be. So we've tried to give you some guidance that tries to address the resident in the hallway. You know, the reality is, yeah, they're a smoker, so they're not going to smoke in their room. So you're trying to, you know, guide them down to, you know, where they're wearing a mask. They go to the smoking location, they're observed, and then they come back and go back into their room.
Thank you.
Go ahead, caller.
Yes, good afternoon. I would like a clarification in regards to a quarantine unit. We have an enclosed 5-room quarantine unit that, of course, we put our residents on when they come back from a hospital or a new admission for the 14-day window. The question I have is, on that enclosed unit, let's say I have 2 patients returning from a hospital same day. Can I cohort for those 14 days as long as they're non-symptomatic?
Are you talking about in the same room?
Correct.
No, you can't, because you don't know what they were each exposed to in the hospital.
Okay, and I wanted clarification on that one, so thank you.
No.
Now, is it the same scenario with the PPE? My team is using the full PPE when they're doing patient cares on that quarantine unit, but can I use, let's say, the same N95 for one employee for her shift, and then she wears a surgical mask over it into each room? So they're different.
Yes.
How can I not run out of PPE if I need to change it on each and every room that my staff goes into? How can I help protect my PPE in that quarantine unit? What are the guidelines?
So you really need to be looking at optimizing PPE throughout this whole thing. Wearing masks and a face shield can be worn room to room. If a face shield or goggles, if anything gets soiled, it should be changed. But in order to optimize those shortage in supplies, you can extend the wear. Same way as if you have a completely negative facility, you can wear that face mask all day, well, with, you know, until the integrity is lost of it. So looking at it from that perspective, you can extend the wear. The only thing that you cannot extend the wear on is gowns. When you do not know the status of someone, which would include your quarantine and anyone else that is not in a COVID-positive status.
Okay, and our building is has been 100% negative.
So... Right. So your quarantine, you can extend the wear of the face shield and N95.
All right. I think that answers. Do we have others? Okay. I think that answered our questions. Thank you very much.
Go
Go ahead, caller.
Okay, so on dialysis, quarantined, the dialysis center is well controlled. We know that. Do we need to use full PPE, or can we treat them like the others, not full PPE?
You must use full PPE for those folks, and it does state that in the CDC guidelines. So go back and check, because dialysis is specifically mentioned. And there is a lot of things that go on in a dialysis unit that they do specific for bloodborne pathogens and for COVID. But being that they are a significant risk coming, going multiple times a week, that sets them at a higher level of risk.
Okay. Thank you.
Go ahead, caller.
Hi, this is Lucy Dykes at Fairview Fellowship Home. I was wondering, do you have any guidance for employees going on vacation? What kind of policy we can put together for that?
Don't have a policy for you for vacationing.
Okay, these people go in places where it's high risk, and I don't know how much control I can hold over them.
Well, when they come back, you know, be sure to test them, ask them the questions that the CDC puts out.
Ask them, you know, you're giving them education already, hopefully. All your staff have received education about what to do out in the community and what you need them to do as healthcare professionals. To wear masks, to do good hand hygiene, not touch things unnecessarily. You know, don't ask them to, you know, not pick a vacation spot that's, you know, on the upper trend, lots of cases. You know, that's what you're asking them to do,
yeah.
Hopefully.
Okay. Also, I was wondering, the biweekly performance monitoring form, has it been put out to us yet?
That's in the works.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we got it. We got to push it out.
All right. I appreciate your help. Thank you.
Go ahead, caller.
Okay, I have a question about the CDC reporting the COVID cases. I'm a new administrator to a facility that's already been registered, and I haven't gotten any response after trying to make the change so that I can register on and make my online input the data. So,
do we have somebody here helping with that?
I never heard of
it.
I know.
So is your question you haven't gotten access to it yourself yet, but someone else in your facility does?
No, she lost access as well, the former administrator. So I need, you know, I've got two more days, and I'm having trouble reaching anyone who can help me with this.
So my recommendation would be to contact the QIO.
QIO.
And they would be glad to help you with that.
Do you have a number? Can you help
me
with that?
I have a number in my office if you will call me at 271-6868. This is Paula. I can give you Sherry.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's Sherry Longacre, right? It's Longacre.
Yeah, yeah. Sherry Longacre Telegen.
Is with the QIO, QIN company called Telegen, and she spoke earlier.
Yeah, I heard. Thank you.
Go ahead, caller.
Hi. Once the information is submitted to LTC at Health, that the email, when can we expect to receive whether or not our plan is approved?
Well, we are still putting all of that together. I hope to have it'll depend on the personnel. I don't have a definite timeline. Let me get back to you on that. We'll have more information next Wednesday.
Okay, and the second part of that is if a corporation's using basically the same policies, only people would be transitioning or regressing or progressing through those stages independently. Could those all be submitted at one time, or is it better to submit by building?
I would submit it by facility whenever you have
it. Okay. Should we submit it before we get whatever thing you're putting together?
We're going to put a packet together that we're going to send out, and it'll be available on the website.
Okay. Thank you.
Go ahead, caller.
Okay. I have several questions. We have a cohorted admission unit, and as well as a few residents that are on droplet precautions for monitoring because they went to doctor's appointments or they're on dialysis and we don't have room on the admission unit. And so I wanted some further clarification on the PPE as far as, gown use and full PPE just for entry to pass pills or to pass a hall tray. That was addressed for the isolated environment, but I don't want to assume that that would carry over.
Let me just clarify. Let me tell you, really, that should probably be more for the quarantine unit than for the isolated unit. So if you're going in to the quarantined room and you're just going to step in just for a moment to hand a quarantined resident their cup of pills, they're able to just take it and take them, then you can wear your mask and not have all your PPE on.
Okay. And then we have had some dementia residents that are on our long-term care side. They are unable to be monitored on that admission unit due to staffing restraints, and they can't remain isolated fully and stay in their room unsupervised all the time. And we attempt to redirect and ensure they wear a mask, but that doesn't always fly with them. And so I didn't know if you guys had any guidance on those residents they need to be on 14-day droplet precautions and monitoring, but we're unable to maintain those strict droplet precautions for those. I didn't know if you had any guidance for that.
I think you need to try to do the best that you can. I know it's a difficult situation. Do you have a separate memory care unit, or are they generally?
We do have a separate memory care unit, but these two residents specifically that this has come up with no longer qualify for memory care due to their needs, the high acuity of their nursing needs, elopement risk, and transfers, they're unable to walk.
Is your quarantine unit physically separated from the rest?
We have,
does it have like double
we
doors?
We have a temporary wall built in the middle of a hallway, and so the cohorted unit is at the end of that hallway, and we have a designated nurse aide that stays down there, and it's very small. There's only six or seven rooms. We have a designated nurse aide, but the nurse has to move between units.
So if your resident with dementia is in the quarantine unit and then wanders, are they just wandering within that that unit and not out in the general population?
Those two we did not feel would be safe to keep on the quarantine unit, because they would need to be monitored and kept in view, and we only have that one associate that's dedicated down there to care for those up to seven people, and didn't want to cause a safety issue there.
Why don't you give me a call, and we'll discuss further at 271-6868.
Okay. And
thank you.
You're Paul.
We're in that? So that's the end of all of our calls today. I will say our next session is next Wednesday, June 24th at 1 o'clock. I hope everybody be well and be safe. Thanks for calling in.